I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is novelist Blake Nelson. Blake, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. We have reviewed your latest novel now twice at Countercurrents. Roger Devlin and also James Amira reviewed it. The novel is called The Red Pill. Blake is a successful published novelist. He's published 17 novels now. A lot of them are young adult novels, and there are also adult novels, although maybe I should call them grown-up novels because adult makes people think of porn.
Exactly.
He's published with a number of major publishers, including Simon & Schuster, Scribner's, Random House, Penguin, and Little Brown. And I'd just like to find out about your career and how you came to write The Red Pill. And I see a kind of unity, maybe, between the very beginning of your career and The Red Pill, and that is that the earliest writing of yours that I've found is an essay called How to Date a Feminist. So can you tell me about how you got your start as a writer?
Oh, yes. That's very astute of you to dig that up. So I wrote my first novel. It was called Girl, and I was trying to get it published or trying to get an agent to help me get it published. In those days, that was a very long process. You would have to mail a query letter, and they would either call you or write you a letter back. And then if they wanted to see the manuscript, you had to mail the 400 pages through the mail. And then so it took a long time between when you finished a book. Then you went through the process of getting an agent or getting an editor interested. And all of that could take 6 months up to a year. So after I finished this book, my first book, Girl, I was going through that process and I was sitting around at my desk trying to think of like, well, how can I help myself while I'm sitting here? You know, what can I do to kind of raise my profile? I was pretty much completely unknown. And so I wrote an article for Details magazine about being apolitical. I was apolitical at the time. They liked it. And so they accepted it. And I thought, oh, here's my chance to, I can write for this major magazine. It was one of the glossy magazines of the time. You know, it was like one of the hipper of the big glossy magazines of the time. And so I was all excited about that. And then one day I sat down and wrote kind of like a story called How to Date a Feminist. It was quite edgy and it was quite pushing on the boundaries. This would be about 1992, I suppose, right as the Riot Girl stuff was starting to happen. And especially in a place like Portland in the music scene, there was lots of sort of feminists emerging. And so the story I tell in my article, How to Date a Feminist, was so I just sort of made fun of the classic magazine style of, so you met this cute girl on your campus and she wears Doc Martens and she rides a bicycle and you think she's cute and now you've asked her out, but it turns out that she's a feminist. What do you do? And then it kind of humorously just, you know, described, you know, well, don't talk about what a cool guy you are, or don't be egotistical because feminists don't like egotistical guys. So I wrote it. It was very funny. And I might have read it at like an open mic or something in Portland and everybody laughed. And so I thought, okay, this is funny and this is good. But at the end of the article, it sort of made all these funny points about how feminists think. And at that point, 1992, your average guy that maybe was in college, like at Details magazine, you're basically writing to college age kids and people in their 20s. And so at that particular moment, 1992, there were a lot of guys, I think, that were just getting exposed to feminists. They were just having their first experiences on campus where they would say something in class and they might get like attacked or criticized. That was just the level of feminism at that time. A lot of guys really didn't know. And so like what I had conceived as like a sort of a joke actually turned out to be kind of, people did need to know it, you know, younger guys who, especially if you didn't grow up in a big city or if you didn't go to like a real fancy college, if you just went to, you know, Eastern Michigan State, you might not really know too much about feminists. But before I sent it in, I had a little moment. I sort of looked at it and I thought, you know, and I remembered what the feminists were like at my college. And I graduated from college in 1984. And I remembered what they were like. And I thought, you know, even though this is funny and even though it is kind of has a good heart, you know, it isn't like mean, this could get me into trouble. So I kind of had to think about that. And then I decided, yes, go ahead and do it. Because if I don't do it, I'll never get my book published because nobody will have ever heard of me. And I won't have done anything to get on to kind of raise my profile. So I'd already had it, you know, I'd made contact with an editor because of my other piece. So I wrote to him and I said, oh, I've got this new thing. It's called How to Date a Feminist. So I sent that in. And they were so excited about it that they bumped the old piece and then they published that piece like immediately, like practically the next day they rushed it into their newest issue because they could see that it was going to be hot. And so it came out. Sure enough, I immediately got calls to be on Shock Jock morning radio shows, like a couple of them sort of scattered around the country. I also got a letter from the National Organization of Women protesting my criticism of feminism. And then at the magazine, and I was still in Portland, but when I eventually got to New York and would hang around at the magazine, I immediately saw that there were some women in the office that really didn't like that article, How to Date a Feminist. But then that the editor-in-chief really did like it, and he liked the idea that I had sort of dared to cross this boundary and, you know, be lightly critical of feminism. And it was very light. The whole thing was very light. The tone of it was really just funny. But sure enough, and you're right, that is kind of exactly where I am with the red pill. It is a case of where I feel like I know where the line is, and I'm just going to put one toe over the line, just enough to make it, to give it some juice and to get people arguing and stuff like that. And so, and it totally worked. Like, and then because of that article, my editor at the magazine introduced me to a kind of a big agent. And then the agent was able to sell that first novel. So it really did work. Like, I took the chance of maybe getting myself into trouble by being unpolitically incorrect with my sort of, with this, you know, you know, at that point, you really just didn't, the best thing to do would be don't talk about feminism, like, because you don't want to get into trouble if you're writing for a men's magazine. But since I kind of went right at it and kind of made it funny, and it was, you could tell by reading it that it was a balanced piece. And then what was really funny, so then for years after that, I would meet straight people and they would say, oh, you wrote that article about how to date a feminist. I had that article on my taped to my refrigerator for 20 years. And, you know, and I would show it to, you know, I would meet women who would say, I used to show that to guys because they were so clueless about, you know, your story about how to date a feminist. And of course, I was kind of slyly making fun of feminists, but a lot of feminists didn't realize I was making fun of feminism, and they sort of took it straight. Like, they really thought of it as a how-to. And it was just very funny. And it goes along with that old idea that if you really nail something, everybody is going to misinterpret it. Because if you really got it right, then if you sort of describe the situation really accurately, everybody will bring their own interpretation to it. So my How to Date a Feminist article ended up being an How to Date a Feminist article, even though it was satirical and was kind of making fun of feminists. But it had a long life, and it really made my career. But then it also followed me through my career. And I many, many times in my career after that, I could tell I was dealing with people that had remembered that article, because it kind of went viral in the equivalent of going viral in those days. And so a lot of people heard about it and a lot of people saw it. And so every once in a while, like if I had to get a new agent and I was, you know, trying to get it, I remember this one time I was talking to this very prominent female agent and she was very interested. And then one day, and so then I talked to her again and suddenly she was not interested at all. And I thought, oh my God, somebody told her about how to date a feminist. And so, you know, so I got a little side. So that article both got me a career and also hindered my career. So it was very, you know, it's just the nature of the beast, I guess.
Well, you know, you've had a really impressive career anyway. So I want to talk a bit about some of the high points of the career. And I guess one thing I want to touch on is the novels that you've written that have been adapted as movies or as TV dramas. There have been several of those, starting with the very first one, Girl. So can you tell me a bit about Girl and how it became a film?
Girl was that first novel, and it was about the grunge music scene. I just hit it right. I just wrote it right at the right time. Yeah, I had this good agent now. And so we were able to sell it. So it came out, and so it kind of caught a wave, and it did really well sales-wise, the book. So this kind of cool, independent film guy used to pay a college student to read Publishers Weekly every week, which is the trade journal for book publishing. It didn't necessarily have to get a good review, but any book that seemed odd or interesting or eccentric or like subculture-ish or underground, he wanted that college girl to cut it out and mail it to him. He just paid this person. I don't know who the person was. And so Girl popped up on Publishers Weekly, and the review wasn't like super good, but it was, you could tell, even if you just look at the review, you can tell that that the book is unusual. Like, that was basically the test. If it's unusual, send me a clipping of it. So this young girl sent the clipping to the producer, and he read the book and he really liked it. He was involved with like people like Harmony Korine and Vincent Gallo and kind of the sort of undergroundy guys of that time. This would be about the mid 90s. He did the movie Buffalo 66, which is one of the great, you know, weird underground movies of the 90s. And, you know, and I didn't have much contact with them. They just called my agent and asked if the book was available. And we did an option with them. And it wasn't a ton of money, but by Hollywood standards. But to me, it sure seemed like a lot of money. So they did it. And it took them a year or two to get the right people and to get a script. And I was not involved. I had heard, you know, I would read articles about people who had movies made out of their books. And the prevailing wisdom seemed to be that don't get involved in it. Just start working on your next book, especially if you're the kind of person that wants to have a real career. Like a lot of writers get kind of sidetracked. They'll get a movie deal. And then and if you have a good agent, maybe they can force the producers to let you write the script, or at least write the first script, and then they change it. I've seen a lot of writers kind of go down that rabbit hole, and you end up spending years screwing around with the movie people, trying to influence them and make them do what you want. And then the movie people don't want you involved because you're going to stick to your original ideas and they might want to change things. And so really, it seemed to me the wise thing to do was to just stay out of it. And my old writing teacher he told me that Raymond Carver had told him to take the money and run. Like, in all these situations, don't worry, just take the money and then leave them alone. So that's what I did. I just stayed out of it. And then when they realize that you're not going to be a pest, then they start including you. And this has happened to me in the other projects. So then they started calling me up. There's a ton of music in the book. It's all about the Nirvana era music scene in the Northwest. So suddenly they're calling me up and asking me, like, well, what do you think of this band? What do you think of that band? And I didn't really want to, you know, I didn't, at that point, I'd sort of trained myself to just stay away from it. And so I didn't really want to get involved in the music. And then I'd have everybody following me around going, get my song in your movie, or, you know. So I just really stayed out of it. And I think that is good advice. And I would advise other people to do that, because, and then that movie came out, and it turned out, even though that producer guy was a really sharp guy and a really interesting guy, as happens to movies, sometimes they just don't work. You know, you get a director, you get a script, you put these pieces together, you don't know if they're going to gel. And really, that movie really was not, it was kind of a disappointment. It wasn't very good. But interestingly, just because it was about a girl and about the music scene, it played endlessly on Cinemax, like at 3 a.m. Like, I just remember for years, I would think, is it still playing on Cinemax? And I would get somebody who had cable and I would click it up, and there it would be at 3 a.m. on Cinemax. And then all these girls, and it's an objectively bad movie if you ever watch it. So then I had to contend with all these weird fans of the movie criticizing my book, because my book, of course, this is sounds egotistical, but my book is pretty good compared to the movie. So then there'd be these fans that would be like, oh, I hated the book. It just went on and on, but the movie was great. You know, and who knows why they thought the movie was.
That is so funny. There's a line in Sunset Boulevard where the screenwriter, who's played by William Holden, says that he wrote a baseball picture, and by the time it hit the screen, it was set on a torpedo boat. Were your novels changed radically at all in the adaptation process, or were you pretty lucky?
No, they weren't. And the thing about it is when you write novels and people are interested in the novels, they usually, the interest is almost always genuine. Like they're not interested in, there's a couple weird cases where people really change the book. But generally, like in my case, they usually just want the character. Like in both, in two of my, well, actually in all of the situations where I've had stuff that actually was produced, what they wanted was they wanted the voice. You know, so in Girl, this the main character of Girl is this very funny teenage girl who just yaks. She just talks constantly, and she's, and I kind of make fun of teenagers, and it's just funny and it's charming. It's just very charming. And then also she has her take on this music world was just interesting because I made her very naive and kind of dumb in a way. But then in her dumbness, she says sort of interesting truths. That's what they want. But they could still screw that up in the case of Girl. And a weird thing about the one time, well, I think I've watched it twice now. When you watch it, the dialogue is kind of nuts and not very clear. But then every once in a while, she'll just spout a whole paragraph right out of the book. And then you're like, oh, that's right out of the book. But it won't sound like the other dialogue. So it's an odd situation when that happens. But I think in my case, they want the central character and they want the central milieu that the character is in. And then if that's what they want, and they have to pay for it, so they're not going to waste their money if they don't like your character and they don't like the world that the character's in. So in my case, they always stay pretty close to it.
Right. So is Girl one of your young adult novels, or is that a grown-up novel?
Well, it was published as a grown-up novel, and it has a lot of adult themes in it. And at the time that it came out, young adult stuff was not a big thing. It was actually kind of a ghetto in the publishing world. So that I don't even think anybody suggested it. Usually the agent will suggest it if they think they can get more money. But at that particular moment, this would be 1992, 93, the young adult world was not, that wasn't a cool thing like it is now or has been the last 20 years. So in that case, they published it as an adult novel. And it also, and it was a little bit edgy, and it has sex and drugs in it, and it's pretty, it was an adult novel. But then 10 years later, the young adult market exploded and became a huge thing. And that was about the time I started doing young adult books. And then it wasn't, and so then they switched it over, and then they published it in the, since I was publishing young adult books, it made sense to move it to a young adult. I think it's the same company. It's still Simon & Schuster, but they moved it into their children's division. So now I was dealing with children. I mean, it's teenagers. So it was repackaged as a teen book.
Interesting. When you write your books, do you think about the potential for film or television adaptation at all?
I don't. I really don't. You're just way better off. I think they can tell. If you're kind of writing, like, in my case, I would never do that because my books are so they're just not commercial. They're just not that commercial. But if you were a guy that wanted to write a thriller and you were writing a thrill, and you're writing like a thriller and you're thinking and you're putting in scenes that are like movie scenes, I think they can tell. And I think that the movie people and the TV people, they really want authenticity out of the books. Like when they buy a property, that's what they call your book, a property. When they buy a property, they want something that, they want the writer in the attic, with the candlelight. They really want a literary artist. They don't want a, Yeah, I mean, except in cases like John Grisham or something like that. But, you know, in a case like mine, if I were to cheat a little bit and sort of make my book more attractive to movies, I think they would be able to tell, and they wouldn't like it. They want authentic literariness.
That's really interesting. It's more integrity than I would expect from that industry, I guess.
Oh yeah, yeah. And the great irony is when you are in when you're a writer, all the writers in New York. If you like write books or articles, then you live in New York. If you write screenplays and TV shows, then you live in LA. And all the people in LA just think that writers are such great artists, and they're so, you know, they're so important to the culture. And then they think the TV shows they write for are just these stupid, you know, they just complain and, you know, and they complain about how terrible it is, and everybody always fiddles with their work. But then if you go to New York, everybody's like, Quentin Tarantino is a genius. Oh, you know, Francis Ford Coppola is the great artist of the 20th century. Like it's wherever you are among the book writers, everybody thinks cinema is the greatest thing. And among the cinema writers, everybody thinks the book writer. It's just a case of everybody's self-loathing, you know, makes them hate whatever they do. Of course, it's all sort of horrible. So.
Yeah, there's a grass is always greener kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It is so funny. It's so predictable. Like, I was in a book group. I lived in LA for a while, and I was in a book group, and the worship of these people. So these people were multimillionaires, and they, you know, who had made, like, you know, you work on some good TV shows, you just make tons of money. So they're sitting there in their mansions. But I would always love to go to these mansions. I never made enough money to be in a mansion. But I would go sit in these mansions with these TV writers, and we would read some book that was not even that good. And they would be like, I just love the way she describes the autumnal forest and, you know, all this stuff, because all the stuff that they can't do in their medium. So anyway, it's very funny how both sides think that the grass is always greener, just like you say.
Yeah, when you write, do you visualize your stories? Do you see them in your head unfolding? Or is that just not the way you create?
Well, what I do is I just try to think of an interesting situation. I try to get like a character and like an initial situation. And then from there, and so then I start it. And whatever that character and initial situation is, I sort of let that play out. And if that seems to lead to other things, and if other characters kind of appear that I like and that I think would be interesting to develop, then I continue. But my process mainly is to, you know, I just write 30 pages of something. And then if it feels promising, I keep going. Or sometimes I'll just write 30 pages of something and I'll put it aside, write 30 pages of something else, put that aside. You write 30 pages of something else, put that aside. And then at some point, if nothing seems to be coming, I will go back and look at those 30 pages and pick which one I thought was the most promising and try to continue like that. But I never know. You know, within writers, there's two approaches. There's the people that kind of have an outline of the whole book. And then there's the people that kind of go on a journey with the book. So I'm in that latter case. I don't want to know what's going to happen. I want to learn as I write the book. I want to sort of let the situations unfold by themselves and let the characters, if you have good characters, the characters will kind of do what they're going to do. And you kind of don't have, you have some control and you can like make things happen that influence the characters. But if you have good characters, they'll tend to do what they're going to do. And so you're kind of following along. And so you have to be, you know, you have to be you have to have integrity. You have to let the characters have their integrity so that they will, and let them show you where the story is going to go.
That's very interesting. The story of yours, the novel of yours that got the biggest name adaptation is Paranoid Park. So how did you end up writing a novel that Gus Van Sant made into a movie? That's a really interesting question. So can you tell us that story?
Yeah. That was amazing. He is literally my favorite American director, like, you know, a favorite living director. So yeah, that was like, That was really crazy. I would tell, I often told people during all that, I would say, you know, you sit in your bedroom and you practice the guitar and you think, maybe someday I'll be in a band. But you don't ever think, oh, someday I'll be in the Rolling Stones or whatever, you know, whatever the band that you dreamed of when you were a teenager. And so that's what it was like to be Gus Van, with the Gus Van Sant thing. You know, when I got my other movie thing, I was like, well, I wrote a good book. I guess I'm going to get a movie. And so, but when it's your favorite director, it's like, it's surreal. It's not, it doesn't, yeah, it was incredible. Well, so how did that happen? So the way that happened was, let me remember, he lives in Portland, and I live in Portland, although I don't really live in Portland. I mostly lived other places, but I stayed in touch with people in Portland enough that my books would get reviewed in the paper. And he saw a review in the local newspaper of one of my other books. And, the book that I did, I guess it was, yeah, one of my other young adult books. And he called my agent, and I didn't know. He called my agent in New York, and I was living in New York at the time, and said, and the agent said to me, oh, do you know who Gus Van Sant is? And I said, oh, my God, yes, I do know who Gus Van Sant is. I'm from Portland. She didn't know I was from Portland. And so they said, but they followed up with him. He was interested, but he did, but some other things came up, and so he didn't do it. So then two books later, I wrote Paranoid Park, and I just, when it was done and I was working on it, I kept thinking like, wow, you know, if Gus Van Sant had liked that other book, he would really like this book, because it kind of was, I kind of have some things I like in common with Gus, and that's why I like him as a director. I like, you know, street kids and you know, teenagers and all this stuff. So so in this case, I did take some initiative, and when the book was in galleys, I figured out who Gus, and I think I had met Gus socially in Portland like once. He didn't know who I was, but because he lived in Portland and was made some of his early movies in Portland, there was some connection there. Portland is such a small town that everybody, you know, knows everybody kind of. And, so I did, I knew who he was. And then of course by that time he knew who I was because he had been interested in this one book. So I actually took some initiative and I figured out who his agent was, and I sent my book to the agent, which is the correct way to do it. I didn't try to, track him down myself. I just did the way you're supposed to do it in the business, which is you send it to the agent. So I sent it to his agent, and the agent was kind of amused by the whole thing, I remember. And she was very sort of excited to pass the book on to him. So he got the book, and I guess he just liked it immediately. And this is the luck part of it. He had been working on another project, and it had kind of bogged down, and he was kind of getting bored with it. And I know how that goes. You get a book and it's not quite right, but you're still working on it. And then something new pops up. And so I think he saw it as a very independent, low budget thing he could just bang out. And he liked all the setting. It's all set in Portland, and it's, it's kind of right down his alley, as I sort of predicted. And so it happened very quickly. They did it, and they made the deal. And he wrote the, he basically cut and pasted, he told me later, the dialogue out of the book, to kind of patch together a screenplay. He's not the kind of guy that writes like official screenplays. He just kind of sketches stuff out. And so he came up with this sort of minimal screenplay. And so bang, it happened. It happened really fast. And boy, was I excited. But the interesting thing about that is I never really felt stressed in my career. I never was really worried about, but with Gus, I was so excited that it was him that I was very nervous. I remember I went to a dinner with him and the French producers. It was financed by European people. And I went to this dinner, this fancy dinner with these fancy aristocratic French guys who were, you know, incredibly wealthy. There was just this bizarre situation. And then some Portland producers. And so Gus always has these sort of local people. He's very loyal to Portland. So he had these really cool, producer guys who I immediately, they went to my rival high school. But then on the other end of the table are these aristocrats. And, so I'm over there trying to talk to the aristocrats about Michel Houellebecq. So I say to him, and that's all I knew about French culture at that time. I was like, I'm a big fan of Michel Houellebecq. And they said, no, it's Houellebecq, or whatever. So we argued about how to pronounce Houellebecq for like 40 minutes. Oh God, I was so stressed out. It was kind of hard. It was a lot of it was hard to deal with, but it was a great experience. I was thrilled.
That's really fascinating. So another one that was adapted was Recovery Road. Can you tell us a bit about that?
When the book came out, and I knew it was like one of my better books. It's a girl narrator, and she's like an alcoholic already in high school, and which it does happen. And so I kind of thought it was a special book, and it got good reviews. It kind of did better than most of my other books. And these producers snapped it right up. It sat around for a while. That one sat around for a couple of years, and they kept trying different things, and I kind of got to know them also. And in that case, I actually, at one point, they were really having trouble getting a script. And I think I asked if I could meet them and try to, maybe I could write the script. And this was the only time I ever did that. But of course they said no. They were like, no. We want a real TV person. Of course, novelists are such artists. We just need a hack to get in here and write a good TV show. So they were great, and they the show was pretty good, I think. And again, because I laid low and I didn't bother them, they wanted me to come to all the stuff, and I got to go to all the shooting of the pilot, and I got to meet all the actors. They diversified it, though. That was an interesting thing. This was about 2014, and all my books are pretty much sort of suburban white people mostly. But they at some point they said, "Oh, it's going to be all all the characters." There was a couple white people, but it was all multicultural, and they had some British kids in it, but they faked their American accents. But that was a little odd. Suddenly all the characters were people of color. By that time, I think Disney was involved. So that must have come from the top. But I didn't think anything of it at the time. I just thought, oh, okay, whatever. But it was pretty good. And it was, people liked it. I never watched TV. When I watched it, I thought, oh my God, the plot was just of course ridiculous. It was like everybody, it was just a soap opera. But people who watch TV said, no, it's good. It's good. It's worth watching. But it was up against The Bachelor. So another one of those moments where, it's just luck. If you're up against The Bachelor, you lose. So it only lasted one season. But I was happy. It was good. The book sold really well. It helped the sales of the book. It was good.
So did you start developing series, like have characters who are popular in one novel come back in later novels?
No, I've never really done that. Because Girl was so popular, and because Girl had a cliffhanger ending, the last page of the book is she's leaving for college, and she's kind of thinking to herself what it's going to be like. Oh, it's going to be this New England campus, and I'm going to drink hot chocolate, and I'm going to live the, read books and learn about, history. And then the last line is, but that's not what happened, not even close. So it's suggesting that she's going to have a wild experience in college. And so then everybody constantly asked me, where's the sequel? Where's the sequel? And so then after 6 or 7 years, I wrote a sequel. And that's Dream School. And that book was really good. I thought that was a really good book. So it wasn't really a series. It was just a continuing of the story. And then like 10 more years later, I wrote a third book about her moving to New York after she gets out of college. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't do that intentionally. To me, that was like a Rabbit is rich. I don't know if you know John Updike's books, the Rabbit books. He would check in with this one character every 10 years to see where he was. And so that's kind of what I was sort of imitating that.
So I really want to get into the red pill, but before we do that, I want to deal a bit with Portland, because you were from Portland, you've lived in Portland, Gus Van Sant was a Portland director, you have a connection to Portland on and off over the years, and I want to ask you about three writers that I associate with Portland, and I also associate them with the themes of the red pill, and those are Chuck Palahniuk, Jim Goad, and Jack Donovan. Have you encountered these guys either in person or their writing? And have they made an impression on you?
Well, Chuck is, yes. I met him a couple times sort of early on. I still see him every once in a while. I don't really talk to him, but I'll see him somewhere. He's very, very famous in Portland. And he really has to kind of lay low, I think. They do things like they'll have to block off a street at Christmas so that he can sign all the books for the millions of fans that he has. And so he's kind of an interesting case. He's like a real cult figure, I guess. But when he first kind of broke out, he was really he was just a big star with Fight Club, and he was very nice, and he would run around and hang out with people, and he could sort of do that initially. And I remember I went to his birthday party once. I went to a dinner that he was at once, and he was just a charming, funny guy, and I like his books. He has a great style, very loose and very sort of populistic, I would say. He's just, you know, he's not afraid to kind of make a fart joke or he's really great. And he's very much of Portland. He might be more of Portland than I am, in a sense. I can't say that I was influenced by him. I'm a little ahead of him career-wise. My first book, I think, was a little before. I had a couple books before he appeared. And so I'm not sure that, you know, but I do, sometimes when I'm struggling with plot, I just think of Chuck and I think of how his plots, he just goes for it. He has plots like, oh, I'm in a plane and we're going to run out of gas and I'm going to recount my life and then the plane is going to crash. That's a real fun, high concept plot. Whereas my plots are more like, oh, she likes me, she doesn't like me. I mean, my plots are so realistic as to be boring sometimes. So that was my takeaway with Chuck. And then Jim Goad was, I never met him. he wasn't in Portland very long, is my memory of it. But when his zine Answer Me came out, that sent shockwaves through the little literary world. I think all over the West Coast. I don't know. I don't even know if he was in the West Coast at that time. But everybody noticed those books. I think one of them was called Rape Me or Rape. Something with rape in the title, and it was so shocking and so out of left field that people were really they just didn't quite know what to do with him. But he was so talented that it was one of those things where in lesser hands he would have just been derided and nobody would have paid any attention to him. But I remember reading those books and thinking like, just the talent. He was just a great talent. And so even when he was writing this stuff that was so extreme and so outside of the normal parameters of, you know, of like mainstream publishing, he got away with it. And I think he was part of this. There was another guy, Adam Parfrey, I think his name was.
That's right.
Carol House, and those guys became these sort of underground stars, and they were, you know, if they had shown up somewhere, people would be like, oh, they were at this thing, or Adam Parfrey showed up at the science fiction conference or something, or, I don't know, but they were very, they had a big impact on things, but you did not see them, and I feel like I've read stuff that Jim Goad has written about Portland, and he said, you know, people were terrible there. Nobody would be friends with him. Nobody, you know, nobody could handle his stardom. And yeah, and I know that feeling. Portland's a small city. It's a very small city, and it can get real claustrophobic if, you know, especially if you're someone like Jim Goad, who's like, he was so far ahead of his time that, you know, people just weren't going to understand him, I don't think. I don't even know if they understand him now, but at that time, he was too big in his thinking for the locals.
Mm-hmm. Jack Donovan is a contemporary writer. He's producing a lot. He's Portland-based or in the Portland area. And a lot of his writing deals with manliness, masculinity, feminism, modernity, and so forth. Have you read his work at all? Because I know he's very much part of the red pill curriculum online these days.
Yeah, I see his name, and I looked him up at one point. I just didn't have a chance to follow through on it, and so I haven't read any of his books, but I have heard of him.
Well, let's talk about The Red Pill. How did this novel come about? It sounds like a really interesting tale of discovery, because you're talking about a guy who's getting red-pilled, but you give the impression that, well, you had to get a little red-pilled yourself just to take it seriously enough to create a real character who's going through this process. So could you talk a bit about that?
Well, the way that all came about was, so I'm writing my young adult books, and I've been in the last couple of young adult books I wrote where I was really focusing on guys. Generally, it's better to write about girls because girls buy books and girls read more books. So if you want to sell more books in the young adult market, you try to write about girls. But the last about five years, I found nobody was writing about boys. Or if they were writing about boys, they had to be gay, or they had to be like an immigrant, or they had to have some aspect of them besides just being a normal American boy. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll be the guy that writes about normal American boys. So even by boys, I mean like 16, 17, 18 years old, which is, you know, which you're kind of, a, you know, you're becoming a man at that point. So I find that very interesting. So one of the things I kept thinking about was, so if you're like a 17-year-old boy, like, you know, in 2016, what are you thinking about? Like what, I go to like sports events and I just watch the teenagers and they beat each other up and they yell and scream and whatever. And, but I would think to myself, is there some effect? Is all this, feminism, like it is, we get more and more progressive as our society just becomes more and more to the left. I would think to myself, how is that affecting these guys? It doesn't appear, there's no outward appearance of any difference. Like, you know, you see teenagers at the 7-Eleven and they're, you know, just acting exactly like I acted when I was 17. And so it doesn't appear there's any difference. But you're thinking to yourself, there's got to be something different about these guys. They must be feeling the pressure of this constant assault on, you know, what they are, which is just white, suburban, middle class, upper middle class, you know, and there's still a lot of people like that in our country. And so the publishing people, you know, I have a good editor, and she sort of let me, even though the diversity was becoming more influential in publishing, she would, you know, she kind of let me do what I wanted to do. And so, but anyway, so I would ask, so I, and then also I got to the age where some of my friends started to have teenagers. And so I would say to them, do they ever, you know, does your like 16-year-old son, does he ever think like about the toxic masculinity? Does that get through to him? Does he think about that? And, you know, and some people would say yes, and some people would say no, and, you know, whatever. But then a couple of my smarter friends told me, oh, you should go on the Manosphere. And I would be like, well, what's the Manosphere? And they'd say, well, it's in the internet. It's places where, you know, there's these boards, the 4chan and 8chan and Reddit and all the, you know, whatever was popular at that time. This is now 3 or 4 years ago. And so, you know, and I kind of didn't do it. And I kind of was, it sounded kind of lame, I thought. And then, but then one day I finally went online and I think I typed manosphere.com or something, not having any clue what I was getting into. And, you know, and mostly I just got crappy things at the beginning. I got lots of, you know, the three magic words to make women fall in love with you, or, you know, buy my DVD that is, you know, explains how to, you know, hypnotize women or whatever. And I think I read that book about the, what's his name, Mystery. I think I read most of that book by Neil Strauss. But that wasn't satisfying what I was looking for. And then I think it was the Reddit forum called the Red Pill, where I sort of found what I was looking for, which was younger guys, you know, college age, high school age, you know, into their 20s, of guys like really talking about what it's like to be a guy in this climate. And it was so interesting, and it was so authentic, and like, oh, it's just great. I just remember like the first week I found it, and I would just pour through the comments and stuff, and just, you know, and the, like the rise of stoicism. Like they were at the time that I was first finding this stuff. There was all this talk about stoicism. Like we were just born into a terrible time, and we just have to, you know, lift weights and educate ourselves and just be as good as we can be. And the women are kind of screwed up because they're full of feminism, and they're, you know, and the culture is kind of against us now. And it was exactly because I knew there had to be that. I knew that had to exist somewhere. And then also I loved the idea that the Manosphere or the you know, some of these particular blogs were like male spaces. And I had also at that time I was reading Tomasi, and he was talking about male spaces and how, and just what a crippling a psychic effect that has on younger men, that they can't even like talk about like just being men or, you know, or whatever. I mean, that sounds sort of corny, but, you know, like the male spaces are being invaded. And that's a real good point. The Boy Scouts are the most obvious example. Like they won't let the Boy Scouts be boys. They have to put some girls in with them. And, you know, there's a million examples of it. So I was very excited about this. And so I really started reading all the stuff. And then that led me to other ones and funnier ones. I was a big fan of Chateau Hartiste and, who else? Arusha, you know, there's all these guys that are, you know, they're so super talented, super funny, super smart. And just, it was like a revelation for me. I was like, oh, I'm so happy to find this. I mean, I wasn't necessarily as extreme politically as they were. Well, actually, they weren't that political at that point. It took Trump being elected. And I think, maybe it could have just been that I was such a newbie, I didn't really understand what was going on. But it didn't, from my perception, it was several months, it was maybe half a year after Trump got elected, that really, they really started to be, these blogs really went political and were really emphasized that part of, you know, they just wrote about that more. And then, you know, I remember Roosh getting more and more like that. And so I say one of the ways I quickly describe my book is it's about a guy getting red-pilled about dating and then about politics, which I felt like that's sort of, you know, how it happened to me and how I think it probably happened to a lot of people. You kind of went on those websites, you know, and I love the idea that most of the people that found their way to those websites did it by typing, how do I get a girlfriend on Google? And it's so interesting to go out into the bigger world. And, you know, just yesterday I had to correct somebody about what an incel was. They were like, well, these incels, blah, 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 blah. And I had to point out to them, incels are not raging monsters who are trying to kill you. Incels are that guy in your math class that's really good at math and has lots of zits and isn't very attractive and is kind of shy. And if somebody doesn't help that guy, he's never going to know. He's never going to kiss a girl. He's never going to fall in love. He's going to miss out on, you know, the greatest human things. And so these guys help each other. And to me, I just thought that just renewed my faith in humanity. I was so impressed by these guys and how they were. And of course, there's elements of it that, you know, that are maybe they are sort of racist or whatever. But the overall feeling I got from it was that, oh, this is great. This is, you know, and it proves that you can't hold down human nature. You know, you can put the screws to the culture in every which way, but the people are still going to find ways to express themselves and express these feelings and thoughts and stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, do you want to talk a little bit about the plot of the novel, the main characters and the story, sort of a dust jacket blurb version, just to give them a sense of what they're in for and what they're missing if they don't read it?
Yeah. Well, the opening scene is the guy is, so the main character is, he's 40 years old, he's divorced, he's trying to date, he's a leftist, or yeah, I don't know, he's a liberal. He believes all the hype. He thinks he has to be an ally to feminism. He has to be liberal in his politics and be respectful of women and do all, you know, listen to women and believe women and all this stuff. And he's that, and so he's doing all that stuff and he thinks he's going to get a girlfriend by doing that. And he's not going to get a girlfriend. I mean, yeah, he probably could get a girlfriend eventually, but he's just having trouble. And so his brother-in-law, who's more conservative, and he's older than, he's not an alt-right person, he's just a Trump supporter type. But he has those basic ideas also of, you know, don't be a wuss with women. So he's coaching the guy, that's the opening scene, is he's coaching the liberal guy and trying to explain to him that he has to be more assertive with women and he has to be more of a normal person. And so they kind of become friends and they get to know each other. And it's kind of the odd couple. The one guy is the liberal and the other guy is the conservative. The conservative guy will say, if you just worship her, if you just follow her around, if you just do whatever she tells you, she's going to lose respect for you and she's going to break up with you. And the liberal guy, every time he says, tells him something like that, the liberal guy has all these excuses. Oh, no, no. You have to do this and you have to do that. If you don't respect women, they won't like you and all this stuff. So it's basically just both sides of the coin. But the guy, the conservative guy, sort of wins the arguments. His plan, his strategies work and the other guy's strategies don't work. And so then what happens is, the guy kind of acquiesces and kind of goes along with these red pill. And meanwhile, he's also on the internet reading the same blogs that I was reading. And so when all the blogs and everybody else turns conservative, now he's faced with the same problem again. His liberalism doesn't want to swing to the right like all the blogs are swinging. But he can't really deny that they are right. They have been right about the gender stuff. They've been right about gender roles and, you know, and romance and dating. And now he finds himself starting to agree with them politically. So I'll leave it right there. But that's the gist of it. And part of the reason when I first started writing the book on my Facebook wall, and this was right around the time that during that first year of Trump. Of course, all of my friends on Facebook were writers. They're all liberals. They all live in New York or Los Angeles. And they would just go on and on. Oh, God, these poor, kind of really annoying. But they, you know, they would say, who voted for Trump? How could anybody vote for Trump? What kind of imbecile would vote for Trump? And this book was kind of me pointing out to them who would vote for Trump. And that was smart guy. Or, you know, the idea that every Trump supporter was like a moron or some sort of Neanderthal. That's what the book was about. And also, for me, growing up in my having had much variety of experience, you know, unlike the kind of, you know, most of these people that I interact with are, you know, they're lifetime liberals, their families liberals, they've always lived in big cities. I lived in Oregon. I did, and I was sort of a redneck when I was a kid, and my dad was very conservative. So the idea that conservatives are morons is completely, you know, I know lots of conservatives, right? Especially when I was younger, when I was a kid. So this was my way to gently explain to all those people, like, this is how you would get a Trump supporter. And then the other parts of the plot of the book are somebody gets Me Too'd. And just the climate is just changing. And, you know, everybody, you know, 2016, 2017, those were very interesting stretches of time. The main character goes through the stuff. The main character goes through the thing, and this it happened to me. It happened to a lot of people I know. I just got so like overwhelmed by the shock of what was happening. First, the shock that Trump had got elected, but then, especially for people like me, the shock of watching the left just become brutal. You know, suddenly they were the kind of, you know, they were being unreasonable and just wildly, violently nuts. I mean, the whole culture had to absorb those two. You know, it was like a 1-2 punch. First Trump gets elected, which freaks everybody out. And then the left starts acting like crazy. And then where's rationality? Where's normalcy? It's like gone. Like there is, it's gone.
So you write the novel and then you take it to your agent, your publisher. I'd like to know about how the industry, I guess, the publishing industry reacted to it. And then maybe you can talk a bit about how readers and reviewers and just the general public have reacted to it so far?
Well, the publishing people, I naively thought that there would be interest in a book that would kind of show everybody wanted to know who voted for Trump. I had the book. Here it is. Here's a book of a person that starts off as a liberal and then eventually would sort of turned into a semi-Trump supporter. But I was wrong about that. The minute they heard the word Trump, they were, the door slammed on every case. And so I quickly realized that I did not have, I thought I might have a hit. And I thought it might be published by, a big publisher. But I quickly saw that that was not the case. And I had a little moment of like, wow, these people are not quite as intelligent or courageous or open-minded as they had led me to believe. Like I was kind of shocked by the complete, there was just no interest. I can't even really describe it. It was a shock. It was, you know, and I'd say explain, oh no, it's funny. The book is funny. It's kind of satirical, but it's truthful. And it didn't matter. Nobody wanted anything to do with it. And so much so that I quickly stopped doing it because I didn't want to damage my reputation too much. There was no point in worrying about that at that eventually, but at the time I thought, oh wow, people dislike this idea so much, I better just shut up. And then I found a conservative publisher, and then I found some people that guided me towards some, you know, there are a couple conservative agents, there are a couple conservative publishers, but even those things were very difficult. And also it was so, the whole political situation was so new. Nobody knew how it was going to play out. Like nobody knew. It was just safer to just stay away from anything like that. So in a way, I understood. But I found my way to Bombardier Books, and they kind of were just open. They were like, okay, yeah, well, you know, we'll give this a try. You know, and I have good sale. You know, they can look you up and see how many books you've sold, and you know, all that stuff looked really good. So they kind of just. Their approach to the whole situation was just, yeah, well, you know, they keep their expenses down and they just quietly publish these books. And so that's how that happened. So then it came out, and then it was another whole round of shock to find out that nobody would even review it. I thought, oh, I'll get some negative reviews. I'll get some situations where people will say, sure, we'll review it. And then they'll, you know, rip on it or be critical of it. Even though there isn't even really that much to be critical of. It's just there's a liberal guy and a conservative guy and they argue and, you know, the plot is interesting and good and, nobody would touch it. They just wouldn't even go anywhere near it. And it was just kind of, it was depressing. And, but I managed to find some stuff that I could do. You guys have, reviewed it and, then I did a reading here in Powell's in Portland, and then I got into some trouble.
Oh, tell us about that. I used to live in Oregon, and I didn't live in Portland, but I lived 4 years in Oregon, and Powell's was the place I would go every time I was in Portland because I'm a huge bibliophile, and so that was like the first bookstore, and then there are all these other used bookstores around. It's a great city for books. So, yeah, tell me how it went and at Powell's. And did you do something at is it Mother Foucault's as well in Portland?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I did a reading there and that went fine. That was very, that's a great bookstore. And that was really fun. And then I did the Powell's bookstore. But by the time I did the Powell's reading, people had found I'd done a public access TV video thing. that had, you know, where I was kind of explaining a lot of the sort of alt-right, you know, the stuff that they thought. And I was agreeing with a lot of it. I was like kind of the guy that was, I was on there with, he was kind of a, you know, I don't think he really thought of himself as alt-right, but I don't think of myself as alt-right. But we just got into it and it was fun and we just talked and, you know, and a lot of ideas that I had picked up from my reading, which, you know, it's like, and I'm not really a politician. It might not have been the best idea for me to be on there, like talking politics, since I've never talked politics in public before. But everything I said was pretty much stuff I genuinely think. So I wasn't embarrassed, but it had a lot of like kind of conservative ideas in it, and somebody found it, and all the Powell's people all watched it, and then they all went on my Instagram and saw that I'd gone to a rally, and you know, and I'd taken some pictures of the Proud Boys, and also taken some pictures of the Antifa, but they determined, because the picture I took of the Proud Boys, I appeared to be standing very close to them when I took the picture, so that must have meant that I was friends with them. But I had taken pictures of the Antifa from very close also, because of course all these people are this whole thing. Like, you could just totally walk through the Proud Boys. It was really fun being around the Proud Boys and seeing what they were like and seeing how they acted. And like, it was fascinating. And then also the Antifa they were equally fascinated. The whole thing was fascinating. I couldn't believe, you know, why are people so scared of this stuff? I don't know. And then it was funny that just recently I was talking to somebody and they were talking about the Antifa they were saying, well, the Antifa is going to beat up the Proud Boys. And I was, you know, the Proud Boys are these fat guys. And I was like, and so I had to explain to them. I said, the Proud Boys are the offensive line of your high school football team. And they are just like those guys. They're sort of gentle giants. They're not, they're not sadistic monsters. They wouldn't let them be in the group if they were like hyper-violent freaks. And then I had to explain to this guy that the Antifa has girls in it. He didn't know that. I was like, there's girls in Antifa. Like when the Antifa comes marching down the street, as is the case of this thing that I took pictures of, that you can't tell always because they have they're all covered up, but those are girls. So it was like, he didn't know that there was like, you know, a third or a quarter of all those people are girls.
So the Powell's people gave you a kind of frosty reception because of this? Is that where you were going?
Yeah. I found out later, there was all this discussion. This also is very fascinating. You know, the thing about how close was I when I took the picture of the Proud Boy? So like if I was very close, then that meant a certain thing. But if I took a picture from a distance, then it was, if I took more pictures of Antifa, I very carefully on my Instagram put about the same amount of pictures of both sides. And they watched this public access show I did where I sort of espoused some right-wing views or whatever. So they handed out this flyer that said I was a racist and a misogynist and a homophobe and just crazy, sort of left wing. But they weren't Antifa. The people that protested at the Powell's were a Powell's employee and some other sort of, young, most of them were women. And they had signs, and I'm not sure who they were, but it made the thing real tense. And they were handing out this flyer that had these crazy accusations on it. So, and then, you know, the reading was very tense. And then they brought in extra security because of the protest, and nobody knew how big the protest was going to be. They didn't know if Antifa was going to show up. Andy Ngo, who gets into fights with the Antifa sometimes, he was kind of checking in to see if there was going to be a brawl of some sort, and then it didn't turn out that there was anything like that. But there was a lot of security around, and it was very tense, and I gave, you know, and I got very nervous. I didn't really speak as well as I would have liked, but I got through it, and they wrote it up in the local weekly, you know, repeating all the accusations of all the things I was. It wasn't a total hit job in the local paper, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sympathetic in any way. And then that got picked up by Lit Hub, which is a big national literary website. And they said all the same stuff. They keep repeating the worst stuff that they say about you, of course. And then I, in each case, I would try to, you know, use it for publicity. I contacted Lit Hub and said, can I come on and defend myself? And, you know, can I be on your, they have some podcasts and stuff. And, you know, they won't, they just never, you know, they won't let you give your side of it. And, so it's, you know, it's just all sort of negative publicity, but interestingly, I've become sort of involved in Republican politics here in Portland. And so I'm on some like groups of people that are Republicans or whatever. So anytime any of this stuff would happen, I would just put up a thing on there. And I got a lot of support from those guys. And sure enough, when all this stuff was happening, the sales of the book jumped up and there was a big increase in the Amazon traffic and stuff. So there was, you know, so I guess it was good in the sense that we sold some books, but. You know, and the whole thing of being someone like you or some of the people that are, you know, much more experienced with this stuff, the first time they call you a racist, no matter what you think, like I thought to myself, okay, they're going to call me this, they're going to call me that. But when they actually do it, it's like getting punched in the face. You know, you survive it. And I had an interesting conversation with a guy, a literary guy. He kind of doesn't understand why I'm doing this. He's like, why would you do this? And I was trying to explain to him, like, if I'm going to go through this part of history, I'm not just going to stand on the sidelines. I'm a novelist. I'm really good at writing about subcultures. The alt-right is a subculture, and it's a subculture that I am capable of having some sympathy for, and I'm capable of accurately describing. And so that's what I'm going to do. I mean, that's my job. That's my role in society. And the idea that I'm going to sit on the sidelines, I'm not going to sit on the sidelines. I want to be, if this is how it's going to go, if this is the little culture war we're in the middle of, then I want to be in it. I don't want to be sitting on the side.
Well, welcome to the culture war. I'm really delighted that you're here. Last year, I was very pleased, very surprised that Chuck Palahniuk brought out this book called Adjustment Day, which reflected obviously a lot of study of the white nationalist milieu, the alt-right, and so forth. It's a satire of this. It's a satire on identity politics in America and where it could go if it goes in a maximally absurd direction. But clearly the guy did a lot of research, and I was really impressed with that. And that's why I was so delighted when I heard about your novel. Here's another established writer, also associated with Portland, Oregon, of all places, which is one of the leftier places in America, frankly. And you've done the same thing. So I'm just delighted with this, because right now there's a huge amount of political correctness. There's a huge amount of repression in our culture. There's a lot of hysteria, accusations, and so forth. We've been suffering from deplatforming attacks and things like that. It's getting really bad. It's getting really kind of scary. I mean, physically scary. And yet, at the same time, my feeling is that this is going to break open soon, that the attempts to repress honest discussions of sort of nationalist, populist ideas and so forth is going to break down, because there are just too many important issues, and people are engaged too much. And when I start seeing mainstream writers like you and Chuck Palahniuk engaging in this from a literary point of view, or mainstream scholars like Roger Eatwell and Matthew Goodwin in the UK, who've written this amazing book, National Populism, I just think that these inhibitions and taboos and attempts at just thuggery and intimidation are failing, and that we're on the brink, if we can just get there, if we can just persevere, if we can stay in the game, we're on the brink of finally an opening and a greater national conversation. We just have to get the broad American public mad enough that they finally just tell these people, shut up, stop shouting these people down, stop trying to censor us. We need to have this discussion. So I'm just delighted to hear from you. And I guess I want to know now, what's next? What are you going to be working on? Are you going to be writing more novels? Are you going to be running for office? What's next for Blake Nelson?
Yeah, you know, I really don't know. I don't know. You know, I was a musician when I was a kid, you know, when I was a teenager. And I remember, you know, like you learn how to play your instrument. Then you learn how to play other people's songs. Then when it comes time for you to write songs, you just copy the people that you learned by. And I remember at a point in my being in bands and stuff of kind of like, well, how do I get my own style? How do I find my own voice? Like, how do I? And the way you do it is you just keep going. You can't really like decide what you're going to be. You really just have to do stuff. And then what you're going to be will appear. I feel like that's how it is with writing novels too. Like you just have to keep writing novels and then slowly you find out what you're really good at and where you really belong. And I feel like, you know, all this stuff, I was never interested in politics before. And so what I have to do, I just have to keep doing stuff. I do stuff with the Republican Party, which I know people, that seems sort of boomerish or whatever. And then I write stuff. I write essays and I wrote a thing for one of Roosh's early websites. And I was quite proud of myself. Like, you know, I didn't probably have any business being on there with them, but I'm just going to keep doing stuff. And then I'm going to just see where I end up. And that seems to be the best way to do it.
Well, it does take some courage to do that. It takes courage to be a dissident today. Leftists pat themselves on the back all the time and pretend like they're the courageous dissidents, but they really control the culture and they're really just bullies at this point. They're entitled, angry bullies who try and shut down people, who dehumanize people who disagree with them, and they act like crazy people. And so it takes a little courage to buck that atmosphere they're trying to create, and I just have to thank you and congratulate you for doing that. So again, welcome. Welcome to the culture war.
Thank you.
Well, Blake, this has been a really good conversation. We've been going at it for more than an hour. I'm going to be following you, following your career. Everybody out there, Blake Nelson's latest novel is The Red Pill. It's been reviewed twice at Countercurrents by two of our leading authors, James Amira and Roger Devlin. It's out there on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and the entire world book market. So if this sounds like something that would interest you or interest a young man that you know, perhaps, definitely check it out. Pick it up. And we will be back. And I hope, Blake, this is the first conversation that we have, and there'll be many more.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you so much, Greg.